Good morning. Everyone knows we're in a time of transition. We keep using that word, and it's a fun word, so I'm going to keep using it. And we've also, another word that's been used quite a bit is ambiguity as well. That's also another fun word. And by the way, if you don't know ambiguity, it's like vague, uncertain, unclear. But it's been used in some of the sermons that have been given recently. Randall Booth, about a month ago, shared from Samuel and what was happening with Samuel, and then, well, actually, Eli, who was before Samuel, then Saul, and then David, and how things weren't always clear about what was God's will at different points, and it kind of kept changing. And then Liz followed up with also, she gave a sermon on ambiguity and how that's part of transition. And now we're in a transition of leadership and where is the future of our congregation going. And last week, Homer gave a sermon, and essentially it was, undo the thing there. It was essentially on discipleship. At least that's what I took from it. Maybe other people got different things. It was a great message. And finally, I want to mention another sermon that was at the New Year back in January. Danny Kopp spoke on the parable of the shrewd manager. Do you remember that, Danny? About 4 months ago. And, oh yeah, I guess this goes into the whole. Got a loose thing here. I guess this goes into the whole memory thing about me remembering things. But Danny spoke on the shrewd manager. It was a great sermon, and he brought it into the context of the Syrian civil war and the refugees, and how are Christians responding to the refugee crisis, and how it's very complicated. I've never done this before, but this morning I want to do a sermon on the shrewd manager. So we can call it dueling sermons with Danny. I have a different perspective, possibly, and I want to relate it to our whole transition and ambiguity. So if you want to turn there, you can follow in Luke, I think it's chapter 16, starting in verse 1. Yep, Luke 16, verse 1. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his money. So the boss called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager anymore.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My boss is firing me. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when he fires me, people will welcome me into their homes.' So he called in each one of his boss's debtors, those who owed him money. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my boss?' He said, 100 vats of olive oil. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly and make it 50. Then he asked the second guy, 'How much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He replied, 'Take your bill and make it 80, quickly. The boss congratulated the dishonest manager because he had acted wisely. For the sons of this world are wiser in dealing with their own kind than are the sons of light. I tell you, make friends for yourselves with dishonest money, so that when the money runs out, you will be welcomed into eternal homes.'" Now, this is my translation here. I think we'll have a little fun this morning, because sometimes when you read things quickly, you're used to certain words and certain cadence of how it comes out, and maybe something might pop out different this time. First off, what's the title of this story? Danny called it The Shrewd Manager. That's a very popular title. There's also The Dishonest Manager. Where are these titles coming from? First off, in the very first verse, it says, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his money. And so, before we get to that, Jesus calls him a dishonest manager, right? So that's where the one title comes from. And then the shrewd manager comes from where the boss says, you acted shrewdly or wisely. And so that's where these two titles are from. And in a sense, they're a bit conflicting. Because if you come with dishonest, you're like, what? Jesus is commending someone who's done something wrong and bad. And so then you've got the shrewd manager, which kind of lightens it a bit, makes it more palatable. So does anybody feel comfortable with these titles? Do you like shrewd? Do you like dishonest better? The shrewd, dishonest manager, we could put both of them together. First off, this guy was only accused. Do you notice that in the first verse? Go back and read it. The manager was accused of wasting his money. It never says that he was proven guilty. Kind of reminds me of the story of another dishonest manager in the Bible. Do you remember him? Judas? Well, okay, yeah. I'm thinking of one in the Old Testament. Joseph, right? He was the manager for Potiphar, and his wife, Potiphar's wife, said, this manager of yours, you know, he tried to rape me. He never got a chance at a fair trial. So, you know, who knows? I'm not saying he didn't do something wrong. I'm just saying at this point, we don't know. But then, as we pointed out, Jesus says he was a dishonest manager. But I wonder if Jesus, when he's telling the story, he's taking his hands and saying in quotes, the dishonest manager. Maybe Jesus is pointing out irony in the situation and gave the manager that ironic title. Maybe we'll see it a bit more clearly. So, to make things interesting this morning, and in the spirit of our current ambiguous transition here at Narquis Street, I'm going to call this parable the ambiguous manager. So, think about that one for a little bit. First off, what is this story? This story is a story of transition, right? Job transition. Think about losing your job, being fired. What happens when you lose a job and you've got to transition from something to something else? People are watching how you react, what you do. I was watching some shows this week, and there was two cases of people in danger of losing their jobs. And in one case, they said, when there's a regime change, stay neutral. Don't pick sides. Another one, when you get demoted, you do something wrong, you don't want to get fired, but you're close to, figure a way to get back on the boss's good side. All right? And in this story of this manager, what does he do? What's it say here? He makes friends. That's a good option too. Make friends. So we're going to come to that. So how does the manager respond? He says, what shall I do now? My boss is firing me. I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when he fires me, people will welcome me into their homes. So he's thinking. He's resourceful. He's thinking positively. He's problem solving. And most importantly, as was pointed out, he's seeking relationships, not more money. If that was his sin, if that was his fault of pilfering or stealing money, he's not going after the money. He's actually giving the money back, giving it away. Kind of like Zacchaeus. Remember the tax collector? He had taken more money than he was supposed to. And he says, I'm going to repay even more than what I took. So in a sense, Zacchaeus is very similar. He's got the same strategy as this manager here. He's making friends. I mean, if people come up and offer you money, you're not going to dislike them, right? Your natural response is, okay, thank you. So he calls in his boss's debtors, and he's basically giving them back money. He reduces people's debts. And if you want to go into the whole historical background of this thing, Randall Booth, my father-in-law, has written an article about these numbers of 100 vats of oil, which is cut down to 50, reflect ancient papyri, where business people, it reflected the actual real price of buying something versus the commission that's being added on to make a profit in business. So basically, he's giving away his commission when he cuts this money out. So again, he's giving money, his own money even, so not his boss's. So what is the point of this parable? And this has been a complicated parable. A lot of people have had issues with it. Because it's ambiguous, it comes up with multiple meanings. And so in our case, I think that's good, because I want it to be the ambiguous manager. Let's read it, the very end. The boss congratulated the dishonest manager because he had acted wisely. For the sons of this world are wiser in dealing with their own kind than are the sons of light. I tell you, make friends for yourselves with dishonest money, so that when the money runs out, you will be welcomed into eternal homes. So, let's start with all the irony. First irony, the boss, who's firing his guy, congratulates him. Usually, you don't congratulate the guy you're firing. The dishonest manager acted wisely. How can someone who's dishonest act wisely? The sons of this world are wiser than the sons of light. Who is Jesus talking about? And make friends for yourselves with dishonest money. The word is mammon. In English, that's a famous word. Hebrew, mammon. You know, what is this dishonest money? The same, and I made it dishonest money here. Many of your translations might have worldly wealth. Do you have that in your translations? Something like that? See, it kind of like dilutes the zing of that, because it's actually the same word that Jesus is using for the manager. You're the unrighteous manager, so be like him and use unrighteous money. What is that all about? So I think the key to understanding this difficult parable is understanding the context, the background. What is mammon? Many translations have here worldly wealth, but again, it's really dishonest or unrighteous, mammon. It's a Hebrew word. It comes from, it's particularly known in Mishnaic Hebrew, which is what we have today with Rabbinic Judaism. It was another word for wealth, like your possessions. If you read the Mishnah, it talks about the Shema that we just did. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. And in the Mishnah they say, love the Lord your God with all your strength is to love the Lord your God with all your mammon, which is all your wealth, all your money, what you possess. All right? Is money or mammon a bad thing? No. I guess it's all about what you do with it, and we all know that. Mammon, its earliest use, though, is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Who's been to Qumran here? Probably most of you. Okay, so you got a little bit of background. The Qumran community, the Yachad, when they would join the community, they'd bring their money in and they'd give it to the group. And many scholars see this group as connected to the Essenes. And again, it's similar ideas, the Essenes, of being in a group. And they use terminology, they call themselves sons of light, right? And I think many of you know this. Sons of light, sons of darkness. So they were the sons of light, everyone outside were the sons of darkness. Dahlia mentioned I came here about 20, 21 years ago, and the year before that, I had just learned about the Dead Sea Scrolls and, you know, these guys and what they were writing. And I learned that they believed, you know, they're the light and people outside are the darkness, and there's this battle with Satan, God and Satan, and we're fighting with God and, you know, devils over there, and the world's going to end, it's coming, it's apocalyptic. And the funny thing is as I'm learning about these things, I was studying the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, I was doing this whole study on the end times, and I was thing, wow, these Essenes, these guys at Qumran sound like us. You know, we also think that, you know, this is the end, and we're in a battle against good and evil. And, you know, ever since these scrolls have been discovered, scholars have been fascinated by them, their connection to our Hebrew Bible, which all of our entire Old Testament is found there, except for Esther, parts of every book of the Old Testament. And they've been trying to understand over the last 70 years also this community's connection to us as Christians, how we started as Christians, early Christianity. For instance, if you've gone to Qumran and you've seen the film, who's prominently in the film at the Qumran site? John the Baptist, right? That he had gone there and he had joined the community. And there's many things that tie John the Baptist together with that group. Jesus, Paul also talks often about the way, and they talk about the way in these writings. Paul mentions this, he calls Satan Belial, which is this very weird term, but they love it at Qumran. So obviously, they know things together. Even in our Gospels, we have John 12:36. Jesus says, "While you have the light, believe in the light, so that you may become sons of light." 1 Thessalonians 5:5, "For you are all sons of the light, sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness." So this thing of sons of light and sons of darkness. And it's very simple. Any kid can come up with this, but this is a common term there. So one of the first scrolls that are discovered there is called the War Scroll. My brother-in-law, Brian Schultz, did his dissertation on the War Scroll. So if you ever want to know about it in depth, I'm sure he'd love to tell you about it. But it's called the War Scroll because it describes kind of an end of the war, end of the world war, apocalyptic. And it's where the term sons of light and sons of darkness is used a lot. And if you read the scrolls at Qumran, essentially there's, I don't know how many members, 200, 300, it probably varied at times. But again, they talk about themselves as sons of light. People outside are sons of darkness. And in the end, in the final war, all the bad people, the sons of darkness, are destroyed. But you know what's even funnier is that if you read some of the scrolls at Qumran, there will be writers there who will start to talk about people inside their own sons of light who have gone dark, who've gone bad. And that evil has come in to their group. And so now only part of the group has got it right. So hilariously, even God's chosen ones are being compromised and losing their faith. Now only a small group of this small group has got it right. You ever been in one of those elevators with the mirrors? And you look into the mirror, and then you see your reflection, but then it goes back a next layer, and then it's another layer, and you keep getting smaller and further away. You almost have that kind of claustrophobic feeling of, okay, now I've got it right, but they don't have it right. And then you start to wonder, do I have it right? And then pretty soon, no one's got it right. Often when I'm reading the scrolls, I feel like I'm reading the diary of a depressed, self-righteous seminary student who is plagiarizing the Bible. And so I can only read so much of them. Jesus said, "For the sons of this world are wiser in dealing with their own kind than are the sons of light." So I just gave you a little background of Qumran and who the sons of light are and how messed up they were. But who are the sons of light today? Sons of light essentially is a way of saying those who are enlightened, right? Those who have seen the light. Thank you, Hank Williams. Those who have been saved. Got all the right answers. So who are the sons of light today? I'm not going to give you an answer. It's up to you. Who are the sons of the world? Essentially, I'd say it's a way of saying those who are outside, right? Those who are out versus those who are in. Those who are non-believers versus those who are believers. And again, you can fill in the blanks depending on your denomination or your whatever you think based off of what you just read on the news yesterday. For the sons of this world are wiser in dealing with their own kind than are the sons of light. Jesus ends by saying, I tell you, make friends for yourselves with dishonest money, so that when the money runs out, you will be welcomed into eternal homes. Jesus is saying, just like the dishonest manager is called the dishonest manager, so too he uses dishonest money to get friends. Who are these friends? Corrupt politicians? Mafia bosses? I think it's important to understand this. We've got to keep Jesus' view of money in context. So take your brain and review all of the stories that you remember hearing about Jesus and money. What does he consistently say about money? I would sum it up as share. Share your money. Share your possessions. Not because I think he wants you to be Francis of Assisi, that he wants you to be poor, but because sharing is the right thing to do. Your possessions represent you. They represent your character. What you do with your money is a good way to measure who you are. Maybe you're wasteful. Maybe like this manager was. He kind of spent on things he shouldn't have. Maybe you are frugal. Maybe you don't spend enough. Maybe you're generous. Why do you share your possessions? Or why should we share our possessions? Why does Jesus command us to share our possessions? And I would say it's not because Jesus was a cult leader, because he was trying to control us and make us do everything he said, like someone who's controlling every move that you do. Maybe some of you have experienced that from different churches. But Jesus says you should share because it's the wise thing to do. Remember, the boss said to the manager, he was wise in what he did. Money buys friends. We know what the world means by that, right? And you can do it in all kinds of illicit and bad ways. But Jesus is agreeing with this in the sense of the way we treat others with our possessions is how you make friends. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Basically, be friends. Again, I can see Jesus using this term, use your dishonest money, with a wink in his eye as he says it. So who are these friends? You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything I have learned from my Father, I have made known to you. John chapter 15. I think discipleship here is making friends. Or making friends is discipleship. It's the essence of the kingdom of God. Discipleship is not a cult. It's not following one leader. It's community. It's the old and the young, the rich and the poor, the educated, the uneducated, the mentally insane and the sane. Fill in your blanks of people in this room. Jesus and his disciples, you know, his disciples are not just the 12. We always think of the 12 as the disciples. But you can also think of other stories where he had 70. And there's women and there's children involved as well. Think of Joanna, Susanna, Martha, and the 14 different Marys. Mary was a popular name back then. I think of this particular story of Mary, the sister of Lazarus, and Martha. I remember she's sitting at the feet of Jesus. And in rabbinic terminology, when you sat at someone's feet, that meant you were a disciple. So there you go. Discipleship is making friends. It's making relationships. It's entering into one another's homes. You think back to the story again of the shrewd, of this manager. He says, when I'm done with this whole thing, I want to be able to go into people's homes. How did Jesus end it? He said, do all of this stuff with the dishonest money so you can enter into eternal homes. Our goal is to be welcomed into homes and to welcome people into our homes. As Homer asked us last week, how do you spell discipleship? Do you remember? T-I-M-E, time. And that is what a relationship is. That is what discipleship is. It takes time, effort, and even money. I tell you, make friends for yourselves with dishonest money, so that when the money runs out, you will be welcomed into eternal homes. It doesn't matter how much we pray and fast, how much we believe and have faith, if we can't cut our losses and give up on our personal profit and forgive the debts that are owed us and build relationships and release our light and our rightness and our righteousness, then we can't be true disciples of Jesus and we can't make disciples. Love must be sincere, hate what is evil, cling to what is good, be devoted to one another in love, honor one another above yourselves, never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. That was Paul in Romans 12. So finally, in this time of transition, may we stay humble and not assume we hold all the answers. May we be flexible, willing to learn, willing to take chances, and willing to make mistakes, willing to forgive, to grow together as family and as friends. May we continue to make friends, mold disciples, and build community. Amen.